Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of not only the books that I have authored, but some articles that I have written and tell you how to access them. Over the years, I have done a good deal of writing, as time allows, to prepare resources that I think should be helpful to you, our listeners. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there information describing the books I have authored, one of them co-authored with my daughter. On the same website, you'll see a tab that says Articles. You will discover there some articles that I produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. For example, one of the most recent articles was my take on the demise of the culture wars and where I think we ought to go from here. Another article that appeared several years ago in a journal for biblical manhood and womanhood is entitled Boundaries Without Bonds. Another is a rebuttal of a tract that appeared several years back. The author attempted cleverly, but as I will show unsuccessfully, to persuade us that the Scriptures do not condemn homosexual practice. After all, that has all been a misunderstanding. Well, there will be others, but I mentioned those three. I'm not a regular blogger, but when sometimes things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article like some of these. So I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. We continue our exposition of the book of Acts. We come now to Acts chapter 27. We find the Apostle Paul in the red zone, so to speak. In football, when a team is on offense and pushing for a score, the last 20 yards in enemy territory is known as the red zone. That's scoring territory from which an effective offense should light it up with touchdowns. Well, in terms of Paul's long-cherished goal, the apostle, though a prisoner in Roman custody, is now in terms of his mission in the red zone. He's now closing in on the capital of the empire via ship, but it's going to be a very scary and hairy voyage, which, humanly speaking, is very much in doubt. We read in chapter 27, verse 1, when it was decided that we should sail for Italy, Luke writes, they, that is, the Roman authorities, proceeded to deliver Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort, a guy by the name of Julius. Embarking on an Adramidian ship, which was about to sail to the regions along the coast of Asia, Asia Minor, that is, we put out to sea. We were accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica. The next day we put in at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul with consideration and allowed him to go to his friends and receive care. And from there we put out to sea and sailed under the shelter of Cyprus because the winds were contrary. And then the ship log continues, and when we sailed through the sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we landed at Myra in Lycia, provinces along Asia Minor. There the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy. He put us aboard it. We'll stop right there. Charged with the task of bringing Paul to Rome, along with a large number of other prisoners, verse 37 says a total of 236 passengers, some sailors, some soldiers, the rest passengers and prisoners. The one charged with this was a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. For the purpose of this transport, they conscripted an Adramidian ship that was going to sail west along the south coast of Asia Minor. Luke, the narrator, says they were accompanied on this trip by Aristarchus, a Macedonian of the city of Thessalonica. These were Paul's friends who voluntarily accompanied him on this voyage to Rome. They deserve special mention by Luke, for some of the apostles' friendship have something important to say to us in forming our own Christian relationships. Let me talk about that for a minute. I mean, after all, they were accompanying him into very dangerous territory, considering the fact that he was a prisoner and he was going before Nero, no less, a madman in power, if there ever was one, and a clown first class. Folks, first of all, there are no greater friends than prisoner friends. By prisoner friends, I mean the kind who so love us that they voluntarily make themselves willing prisoners of our circumstances. I've seen a lot of those, and they're very special. The dominant, but not only, fabric of such unusual friendships is a mutual love for Christ that bonds people into spiritual soulmates. Such persons whom God brings into our lives gravitate to us out of trust, respect, a shared agenda, and a deep admiration of personal qualities that create deep resonance within them. Such was the bond of these men, Paul, Luke, Aristarchus, among others with Paul. These were people who were willing to take a bullet for him and to make any sacrifice necessary to help him discharge God's work, even in this dangerous position. Paul, in his life of singleness, a marital status self-imposed by his own testimony, 1 Corinthians 7, imposed so that he might position himself better to render undistracted service to the Lord. He needed such friends, and God gave them. Considering all the rigors of Paul's labors for Christ and all that he had to suffer along the way, my, he needed them. That rare social support God certainly provided. For I tell you something, God's provision is always equal to his plan and the demands of our service. So the Lord, notice, placed people around Paul who in some instances were as loyal to Paul as Paul was to God. One of those prisoner friends was a physician, Luke. Luke writes, when he says we in first person, and another was Aristarchus, who had suffered for Christ at Ephesus. And here on board this vessel, headed for Rome, he attends the apostle and he ministers to Paul even in chains. 1 Corinthians 4:10. Unfortunately, not all of Paul's friends proved so loyal, but these two, Luke and Aristarchus, among others, never wavered. You know, many are happy to associate with the rich and the powerful. They're like a social saucer who gladly receive what overflows the full cup. They're always friends who will rally around you when things are going well. They're there when all is cheery. They're there when you have an overflowing abundance to share with them. But most of those will drop you like inconvenient baggage when your fortunes go south. I remember a sad situation like that in the case of my daughter and son-in-law, who for years have just lived through hell with a terrible, terrible illness. It's recounted in my book, Polishing God's Monuments. This was about 1988. Julie and Paul had graduated from Wheaton College, and they were intending to go into missions and spend their life there, so they had enrolled in the seminary where I taught. And very shortly, because they're very upbeat, charming young people, good-looking, they soon found friends. But when Julie's illness and then Paul's overtook them, when the two of them got so sick that they were laid up and they had nothing to offer their little seminary social circle, nothing any longer to offer except the opportunity to be Christ to them, well, that ended that. In a short time, that circle of friends simply bagged them. That kind is not what we call a prison friend. As our Lord Jesus Christ said, greater love has no man than this, that one lay down his life for his friends, John 15:13. In the Old Testament, Jonathan, the son of Saul, you recall, willingly deferred to his friend David in the matter of his claim to the throne of Israel. It is said of Priscilla and Aquila, Paul's dear friends whom he first met in Corinth, that, by Paul's own words, they risked their necks for me. Friends, I'll share a couple little secrets with you. One, in all your life, you will find only a few friends like that. So I mention that so you'll not be unrealistic in your social expectations. For misguided expectations will lead to bitter disillusionment and souring cynicism. Two, the only people I believe who will ever find friends who are closer than a brother are those who first learn how to be real, to be loyal, to be self-sacrificing friends. When I was teaching in Bible college, I was kind of the default counselor of a great many of the students. I remember one young woman who came there who was kind of a bloodsucker. She always wanted attention, always needed attention. She had a way of just coming out of the walls to seek that attention, and she used the need for counseling as her excuse. And finally, one day, I just had to tell her. There was nothing ever going to help her. Somebody had to be blunt with her, and I was up to that. And I finally told her, I said, young lady, let me tell you something. You're always crying out for friends. Nobody loves you. You're not going to find people to love you unless you love back. You're not going to find friends until you become a friend. You go out and work on that, and things will change. I don't know whether that ever happened because I was long gone after that, but certainly that was true, and I hope that that happened. The only kind, number three, who are likely to find those rare prison friends are those who are wholly dedicated to some galvanizing purpose that is higher than themselves. I want to say that again because I want you just to kind of ponder it. I don't make this an axiom, but it tends to be true. The only kind who are likely to find those rare prisoner friends, as I've described them here in this study, the kind that Paul had with him on this voyage to Rome, are the kind who are wholly dedicated to some galvanizing purpose in life that is higher than themselves. And in this case, that galvanizing purpose was to proclaim Christ and draw men and women to him. And number four, when your life is all about Christ, that godly passion will tend to repel shallow or superficial friends and tend to attract those who are closer than a brother. That was the Apostle Paul. You know, that principle applies even in the secular realm. For example, the grand vision, good or bad, of Alexander the Great attracted loyal men of the same spirit. Self-absorbed people rarely attract selfless friends, but more likely, self-absorbed people will attract their own cutthroat kind, who see only something to gain for themselves in whatever friendships they manage to form. Then there are those timely situational friends that God raises up for times of crunches and crises. They may not be friends forever, but in a certain life situation, they are friends for real, and we should never look down upon those. Here, this centurion was one of those timely situational friends. You see these, for example, in Daniel 1:9 and Esther 2:9 and Genesis 39. Potiphar, Moses, Pharaoh's daughter, Jethro, otherwise known as Reuel, who became Moses' father-in-law, Cyrus the Great and Ezra, King Artaxerxes and Nehemiah. Whenever God's servants truly need a helping hand, I'm saying that God has a way of raising up helping friends, as we're seeing on this voyage here in Acts 27. This Roman centurion, Julius, fit right into that category. Not necessarily even a believing friend, but persons with whom God gives his servants timely favor and a means of protection. I've experienced those in my life, and you probably have in your own. I remember one time my wife and my daughter and one of their friends were coming back on a plane from Dallas. The story is much, much too long and involved, but it was a very, very touchy situation. My wife and my daughter really needed some help from flight attendants, but the situation was such that they were not only not getting that help, they were getting just the opposite, and it was hard to make them understand. Well, God worked it out so that our friend with them was able to kind of peel off one of the flight attendants, a man, and to explain to him with a little more clarity what they couldn't explain, the situation. It so happened that the guy's mother was in a similar situation, and it so touched his heart that this guy bent heaven and earth to try to be their assistant on that flight, much to the envy of everybody there. I wish I could tell you the whole story. It was a great story. It's in my book. I'm not trying to sell my book, but it is in my book, Polishing God's Monument. I'm just saying that God has a way, as we see here. He provides those prison friends, and I've explained to you how those prison friends are usually created and what we mean by that. And then he supplies along the way as we need them, as he did in the case of Julius, this centurion. He supplies for his servants those timely, those seasonal friends. They may not be friends forever, but they're friends indeed at that time. Well, in verse 10 of chapter 27, the ship and its passengers had run into difficulty. We read that when we'd sailed slowly for a good many days and with difficulty, we arrived off Cnidus. Since the wind did not permit us to go further, we sailed under the shelter of Crete off Salome. And with difficulty sailing past it, we came to a certain place called Fair Havens, near which was the city of Lasea. And Luke's travelogue continues, verse 9, and when considerable time had passed and the voice was now dangerous, it's a dangerous season, since the fast, that is the Day of Atonement in October, which also kind of marked a change of seasons, since the fast was already over, Paul began to admonish all those, the pilot, captain, and the centurion. He said to them, verse 10, men, I perceive, this is of the Spirit of God, of course, I perceive that the voyage will be certainly attended with damage and great loss, not only of the cargo in the ship, but of our very lives. But as we would expect, the centurion was more persuaded by the pilot and the captain of the ship than what was being said by Paul. You know, the world always takes the expertise of the world more seriously than the expertise of the prophets. Well, in verse 10, we've got a guaranteed passage, God's promise to get Paul to Rome to bear witness there and before Caesar. But a guaranteed passage does not necessarily mean in life easy sailing, and it didn't in this case. In other words, as I make this application in our walk with God, a successful run does not necessarily mean a free ride, and that they were not going to have en route to Rome. It was going to be a very, very dangerous and frightful thing. The only person that knew it at the time was the Apostle Paul, because God had revealed that to him. You know, God has promised to bring us into heaven, but along the way, we may, and some of you already have, had to weather some very terrible storms. Who knows what's up ahead? I'd make another application here, and that is this. Folks, that nothing has really changed. When it comes to food for thought, the unbelieving typically feed off the bottom shelf. That's what we see here in this exchange between Paul, what he predicts, and the advice, the opinion of those who were running the ship. Until things get really desperate and hope is fading, most people are going to take the world's gurus more seriously than they're going to take God's prophets. The experts always have an edge on the prophets. The natural man always feels safer following the counsel of worldly sages than the counsels of the Word of God and men of God. For example, I could tell everyone who would listen that science and technology, as useful as they are, they're neither going to save the planet or human life on it. But in the end, they're only going to accelerate our own ruin. But who are they going to listen to? You know and I know, just as in this case, they're going to listen to the experts, of course. For example, I could tell everyone who will listen that the great majority of emotional and psychological problems that people experience, I can tell them, I'm not the only one. But men of God know those have spiritual roots, and therefore they must be dealt with on a spiritual basis. But how many people are going to listen? They're going to go out and find them a psychiatrist or a psychologist, and they're going to listen to them. That's the way it goes. I'm showing you that what we see here is just a little vignette of what we see in life in general. When it comes to food for thought, the unbelieving typically feed off the bottom shelf. I say again, until things get really desperate and hope is fading, most people are going to take the world's gurus or experts far more seriously than they're going to take God's preachers. The natural man always feels safer following the counsels of worldly sages than the counsels of God's servants. For example, I could tell all of our pundits and policy shapers and decision makers that there's no way, there is no way that there's going to be peace on earth and goodwill among men. It's not going to happen. But that the only real peace, there's going to be peace, must first be found in peace with God. That then, and only then, when we make peace with God, will we find the peace of God. And that peace, and that alone, will quiet the savage beast in the human breast. I could tell people that. I'm not the only one. All of God's faithful servants, preachers, could tell them that. But they're not going to listen. Classic example of this. But the centurion was more persuaded by the pilot and the captain of the ship than what was being said by Paul. I could tell people from daylight to dark that fulfillment and happiness in life is not found in the abundance of things that people possess or the opportunity to partake of the ordinary pleasures of life. I could tell them that. I could tell them that those things are found in knowing God and abandoning oneself to doing His will. But you know and I know what they're going to do. They're going to listen to the experts who will assure them otherwise. I could tell people until my voice gives out that Darwinism is one of the biggest hoaxes ever foisted upon humankind and is responsible for an enormous number of the evils that have afflicted this race since it took root. But who out there is going to listen to a biblical account of reality? Well, that's the way it's always been. The human race has historically listened to its own sages, the way Pharaoh listened to his magicians, rather than God's servant, Moses. Until, of course, they had to learn the truth too late. I can tell the world. I can. All of God's servants can, if they're faithful. We can tell people out there until the cows come home that protecting our physical environment is no threat at all compared to the corruption of our moral environment. I can tell them till the cows come home that the latter, the corruption of our moral environment, is destroying our foundations like a storm tide while we're preoccupied with a couple of leaks in the roof. But who are they going to listen to? You know and I know. Just exactly as it was on this voyage, when Paul's perceptive apparatus, influenced by the Spirit of God, confided to the centurion, his friend, his occasional seasonal friend, as we explained earlier, "Sir, we're going to have trouble on this trip." But the centurion wanted to go along with the pilot and the captain. They were the experts of the ship, the experts of the sea, the maritime smart guys. He was more persuaded by the pilot and the captain of the ship than what was being said by Paul. That will eventually change, but unfortunately it was almost too late. So it is in the world today. Well, thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.